Okay, so we will start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo, excuse me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so so today we will be taking sutta number 103 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Khyenti Sutta. And from the sense of it, we get the meaning is, well, actually, Khyenti means literally just how or what. But from the sense of it, I think the title that Venerable Nyanamoli gave was, "What do you think about me?" And one gets the impression, well, first the topic, the basic topic of the sutta is how to resolve disputes within the Sangha. And one gets the impression from the sutta that it was spoken by the Buddha perhaps very close to the end of his life, when he foresaw that he wouldn't be around much longer to settle disputes. So he had to lay down some guidelines for the Sangha, how to settle disputes that might arise. Okay, so we'll start from the beginning. And it says that the sutta takes place when the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living at Kusinara. This is according to the singular script edition of the sutta, the Burmese script edition that's on the Chattisangayana website. Chattisangayana Tripitaka website has a different city, Pisinara, but I suspect that that is a mistake. And if it really takes place at Kusinara, then this would be some evidence that the sutta is taking place even perhaps even on the verge of the Buddha's passing away. Because if you know anything about Kusinara, you know that that is the place where the Buddha's parinibbana, or passing away, took place. And I don't recall other suttas that take place at Kusinara apart from those that are connected with the Buddha's passing away. So if that's the case, that this sutta takes place at Kusinara, then it could have been, the sutta could even have been something like, you call it deathbed instructions. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha calls the attention of the monks, and then he asks them, what do you think? It's a little bit strange, this question, but he says, what do you think about me, monks? Do you think that the recluse Gotama, that's referring to himself by his proper name, teaches the Dharma for the sake of robes, or for the sake of alms food, or for the sake of a resting place or lodgings, gifts of monasteries, or for the sake of, in Pali it's bhava bhava hetu, which is translated here, for the sake of some better state of being. And the implication here is for the sake of gaining rebirth, you know, for the sake of acquiring merit in order to be reborn in some superior realm of existence, like in the heavenly worlds. And so apparently this would be the reason why some other teachers would have taught the Dhamma, or would have taught their own, I'm sorry, would have taught their own teaching. That is, because they were out for material gain, know, having renounced the world, you still have to cover the body with robes, unless you are a member of the sky-clad sect of the Jains, in which case that is the, or one of the other sects of naked ascetics, then you don't have any worry about robes. But even if you belong to that sect, you need alms food, or you need a dwelling place. Okay, so the Buddha raises this question, and then the monks say that they don't think that the Buddha teaches the Dhamma for the sake of robes or alms food or a dwelling place or to be reborn in some higher realm of existence. So then the Buddha asks them, if you do not think in that way, then what do you think about me? In other words, why do you think I'm teaching the Dhamma? And then the monks say, we think about the Blessed One, that the Blessed One is compassionate, anukampako is the word that's used, one who has sympathy or compassion, and one who seeks our welfare, hitesi, that is, one who seeks our good, our benefit. And so he teaches the Dharma anukampang upadaya, out of compassion for us. So it seems that the Buddha is setting up this initial part of the teaching in order just to get confirmation from the monks that they truly have trust in him, and they recognize that he's teaching the Dhamma not for the sake of any worldly benefit for himself, but because he truly has compassion for them and concern for their welfare. And so once the Buddha gets that confirmation, then he's assured within his own mind that the instruction that he's going to give will be accepted by the monks out of a recognition that these instructions will be truly given for their well-being and for their spiritual progress and for their ultimate attainment of liberation. Okay, and now comes very important teaching. You might say that this is almost like the core or the essence of the final instructions that the Buddha will be leaving with the Sangha. So he says, these things that I have taught you on the basis of my own direct knowledge, my own superior or penetrative knowledge. Then he mentions these things that he's taught over and over again throughout his whole teaching career. So he sums them up as the four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right kinds of striving, or the four right efforts, that's the four samapadana, the four bases for spiritual power, that's the four iddhipada, which is taught for the basis of, I'm sorry, as the means of acquiring supernormal powers, but also as the means for reaching liberation. Okay, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the panchindriya, five spiritual faculties, the five powers or strengths, the panchabala, the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven bojanga, and the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, Arya Atangika Mago. Okay, so that sums up the essence of the Buddha's teaching. And now comes the important instruction for the monks. In these things, you should all train in concord. in harmony with mutual appreciation. That is, rejoicing together as you're all training in these things and without disputing about them. Okay, so this is sort of the Buddha giving these quintessential instructions. And now let's see, you know, as I'm getting older, my memory is getting rusty. So maybe some of you can help me remember some of these groups. So we have the four foundations of mindfulness. Let's see, what are they? Gee. A little cloudy in my memory. Who can help me? And get them in the right order. Exactly in the order. Okay. Obas?
Mindfulness of the body.
Yeah, go on.
Feelings.
Okay.
Yeah, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, the mind, and the dhammas that's conducive to our liberation.
Okay, okay. So we have the four foundations of mindfulness. So we have contemplation of the body, contemplation of feelings, contemplation of mind, and then contemplation of dhammas. Dhammas being a very broad category that includes both things that are obstructive to mental development, like the five hindrances, and things that are beneficial, like the seven enlightenment factors. So these are the four satipatthanas, four foundations of mindfulness. And now we have the four right efforts, or four kinds of striving. Who would like to enlighten us about these? You've been memorizing the list?
I am facing the computer, so. But I do remember the four.
You do remember the four?
Yes. Arouse wholesome state of mind.
Wait, let's get the right order.
Okay. Then affair.
Nobody.
Any unwholesome states that has arisen, you, with restraint, push it away.
I think you're a little bit off, but that's one of them.
I can name them, just not in order, maybe.
Excuse me?
I can name them, just not in order, maybe.
Okay, since nobody is getting in order, you just try out, even if it's... Wait, go back. Now there's another one with the unwholesome.
And the unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. Yes.
Okay, good, good. Okay, take the microphone.
Okay, so any unwholesome states that has arisen, you push away with restraint. Yeah. Any unwholesome states that have yet arisen, you keep it away with...
Yeah, that's right. You prevent it from arising.
From arising, any wholesome states that has arisen, then...
Wait, let's get...
Any wholesome states that has arisen...
Yeah.
You provoke those thoughts of wholesome minds,
Yeah.
And then any wholesome states that have not arisen, you also provoke.
Okay, you're on the right track, except those two should be inverted. Because first, the wholesome states that have not yet arisen, first you have to arouse them, bring them up. Then the wholesome states that have already arisen, then you have to stabilize them and develop them further till they reach fulfillment. Okay, so he got the all four right, though the order a little bit off. Okay, so to get them in the right order, you have to remember first you divide into the unwholesome and the wholesome. And the Buddha usually takes the unwholesome side first, because that's what you have to get rid of. So the unwholesome that has not yet arisen, one makes the effort to prevent it from arising. And then the unwholesome that has arisen, one makes the effort to remove them, to dispel them. So those are the two right efforts regarding the unwholesome. Then regarding the wholesome, there are also two right efforts. The first is that when there are wholesome states that have not yet arisen, then one has to arouse them or bring them up, generate them. And then with the wholesome states that have already arisen, then one has to stabilize them, strengthen them, and develop them to fulfillment. Okay, so that's the four right efforts. Very good. Okay, the four iddhipadas, the four bases for success, sometimes called the four bases for success, or the four bases for spiritual power. Maybe this is not so familiar. Do you want to try it? Oh, boss?
Yeah.
Okay, take the microphone again.
First is will.
First is will,
yeah.
Effort or energy.
Okay, good, yeah.
Consciousness.
Okay, good, yeah.
And investigation.
Very good, excellent, yeah. Okay, so the first is, the Pali word is chanda. One translation is will, also translated desire. So this is the desire to, it could be the desire to achieve a certain goal, or the desire to strengthen the wholesome. Okay, the second is virya, which is energy or strong effort. Then the third is citta, which can be rendered consciousness or mind. This is using the sort of purity and brightness of the mind as a basis for development. And then for achieving success. Probably this is pointing to samadhi or concentration. And then the fourth one is investigation, vimamsa, which is using wisdom as the means, or inquiry, examination, as a means to develop wisdom. Okay, then comes the five indriyas, or spiritual faculties. What are the five spiritual faculties? To what?
The Sakku Dai.
Oh, no, I don't want you to look in the sutra.
No, you don't have to wear any
sutra. I want to see who has them by memory. Wait, you're going to... Now, this is a star student. Okay, please.
Faith.
Yeah.
Effort of energy.
Yeah.
Mindfulness. Concentration. Wisdom.
Right, excellent, excellent. So faith, energy or effort, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. And the five balas or powers... Okay, Johnny.
It's faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. It's the same.
Right.
It's the same.
Okay, good. Okay, now we're getting into the upper stratosphere. Seven factors of enlightenment. Who's going to help us with that?
When they can buy
you. Oh, no. You're a veteran, yeah. Bowie. Take the microphone. Speak up.
To enlighten the vector of mindfulness.
Yeah.
And then to enlighten the vector of the forgot.
You forgot. See you.
Investigation.
Okay.
Energy.
Okay.
And then it's PC and then rapture.
Yeah.
And then it's
okay, so, tranquility.
And then opaque.
Is it really opaque?
No, the last one is equanimity.
Yeah.
And the sixth one is samadhi.
Right.
Concentration.
Okay, concentration.
The one before the samadhi is the tranquility.
Yeah. And so go down.
Investigation, rapture, energy rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity.
Okay, so let's get them. Mindfulness, investigation of phenomena, energy, rapture or joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And now we come to the Noble Eightfold Path. Who's going to get the factors and the right, all the eight factors exactly in the right order?
Let's try.
You want to try?
Yeah.
Okay, take the microphone.
First, right view.
Okay.
Right
right action, right view, that we have right effort.
No. Okay, this has to be in the right order. No, you can. Okay, we'll take Osman again. Okay, take the microphone. Okay, we have right view.
Right intention.
Yeah.
Right speech.
Right.
Action.
Yeah.
Livelihood.
Yeah.
Mindfulness.
Okay, we have livelihood. What's after right livelihood?
Mindfulness, concentration, right mindfulness, right concentration, right effort
comes after right livelihood comes right effort, then right mindfulness, and then right concentration. Okay, so now we put them in the correct order. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, then right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So those are the 37 factors that the Buddha has emphasized again and again. And so later, I don't think one finds this in the older suttas, but later these seven groups come to be collected under the name of the 37 Bodhipakkhiya Dhammas. So these are literally the 37 dhammas or factors or qualities that pertain to enlightenment, that are on the side of enlightenment. Or sometimes they're translated the wings to awakening, or the 37 aids to enlightenment. Okay, so if we're going to train in concord with mutual appreciation without disputing, first you have to learn them. Truly. Okay, now comes, we call it the core or the essence of this discourse, and that is what to do when different views, the different interpretations emerge. Okay, so now I'm on page 848. The Buddha says, while you are training in concord with mutual appreciation without disputing, two monks might make different, might make different assertions about the higher Dhamma. Now actually the word that's used in the Pali here is Abhidhamma. But I think here the translation, higher Dhamma, implying that there is something higher than the regular Dhamma is not correct. But rather, and it's not the case, you know, later there emerges a systematic form of the Buddha's teaching coming from the Abhidhamma Vitakka, and then this philosophy is called Abhidhamma. But that's not being referred to here. The prefix abhi, this is sort of what's been determined by philologists, special linguistic specialists, that the word abhi is sometimes used simply to indicate reference to something. And so what is really meant here is simply that they make different assertions with reference to the Dhamma. And even according to the commentary, even the commentary doesn't interpret the word Abhidhamma here as referring to, you know, the later philosophy of the Abhidhamma system. But it says that what's meant by Abhidhamma here is simply the 37 aids to enlightenment. So these are different opinions, different interpretations that emerge about the 37 factors that the Buddha said you should train harmoniously in. And so now the Buddha is going to go through different bases for conflict or dispute and how to settle them. And he mentions two main ways, or two main spheres, we could say, two spheres or two factors over which the dispute can arise. One of these is the meaning or the substance of the teaching. The other is the phrasing, the wording, the expression. So in Pali, this is the two things around which disputes can arise is artha, which is meaning, and vyanjana, which is the formulation, the expression, the wording. Okay, so now we have a case first where the monks have been divided about both the meaning and the phrasing. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to give instructions. How does one settle this dispute? He says that whichever monk you think is the more reasonable should be approached and addressed thus. So you have two sides disputing. If there is a monk, say, who's not involved in the dispute and who seems to be learned and wise, capable of sound judgment, then one should go to him. But if all of the monks are involved in the conflict, then one should, to settle it, one should look to the one who seems to be the most reasonable, the wisest, the most learned, and most balanced, the one who's likely to be able to consider both sides objectively without firmly and tenaciously holding to his own position. So the monks go to this one, the more reasonable, and one says to him, the venerable ones are differing. They're disputing about both the meaning and the phrasing. The venerable ones should know that it is for this reason that there is a difference about the meaning and difference about the phrasing. Let them not fall into a dispute. Okay, so now it seems that in this case one is going to the most reasonable of the monks who are disputing. It seems that it's picturing a case where there's a dispute on all the monks are involved in the dispute. So you go to the most reasonable and then tell him about the dispute. Then you go to the most reasonable one on the opposite side and okay, you go to the one on the opposite side, the one who seems to be the most reasonable, and you tell him that there is a dispute. I have to say, it's not so clear how one is actually going to resolve the dispute. But so it just says that what has been wrongly grasped should be borne in mind as wrongly grasped. And bearing in mind what has been wrongly grasped is wrongly grasped. What is Dhamma and what is discipline should be expounded. I don't see very clear guidelines on settling the dispute here, except by referring it to the Dhamma and the discipline. How would one go about settling a dispute in case there's differences in both the meaning and the phrasing? What do you think? Maybe we should go on to see the next case. Okay, here there is a difference about the meaning, but agreement about the phrasing. Okay, so then whichever monk you think is the more reasonable out of the monks who are divided on the two sides, you go to him and you say to him that the Venerable Ones differ about the meaning, but agree about the phrasing. Okay, so there's no dispute about the phrasing, but it's the interpretation that differs. So in this case, the Venerable One should know that it is for this reason that there is difference about the meaning but agreement about the phrasing. Let them not fall into a dispute. Then you go to the one on the other side who seems the most reasonable, and you say to this one that the Venerable Ones differ about the meaning but agree about the phrasing, and that there is, for this and this reason, that there is difference about the meaning, but agreement about the phrasing. Let them not fall into a dispute. Again, it just says, what has been wrongly grasped should be remembered as wrongly grasped. What has been rightly grasped should be remembered as rightly grasped. And bearing this in mind, what is Dhamma and what is discipline should be expounded. So here, again, there's a dispute, but how does one settle it on this basis? Let me take an example of a case where there's a dispute about the meaning, but agreement about the phrasing. Okay, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the refrain from the Satipatthana Sutta, if you remember, or you don't have to remember, we can look at it. You go to sutta number 10. On page 145, where the Buddha's laying out the basic formulation for the practice of Satipatthana, there's section 3. We have here a monk abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful. Now we have the expression having put away covetousness and grief for the world. In Pali it's vinaya loke abhijja dominasa. And now, what's called covetousness here, abhijja, is connected with desire or craving, and grief or domanasa is connected with ill will or anger or resentment. And so this is often interpreted to mean that one puts away the five hindrances. Okay, so this is something like a shared understanding of this phrase in the Satipatthana Sutta. But now there's a difference in the way having put away covetousness and grief for the world is understood. The dominant way of understanding this is that as one is practicing Satipatthana, one is in the process of putting away greed or craving and sorrow or grief, ill will. And so the practice of Satipatthana is a means for overcoming these defilements of craving and ill will. But there are some interpreters who say that because of the grammatical form vinaya, having put away, there are some interpreters that say this means that first one has to overcome, at least temporarily, craving and ill will, and then one takes up the practice of Satipatthana. And so then they say that the way to put away covetousness and grief is through developing at least the first jhana. So this means that first one develops jhana, and then one practices the four satipatthanas as the means for gaining insight. And so on this interpretation, first one has to achieve at least the first jhana, and then one starts to practice the four satipatthanas. But on the dominant interpretation, one could start off just as, you know, a well-intentioned, ordinary person without any special attainments in meditation. And then as one is developing Satipatthana, one is removing covetousness and grief, or covetousness or craving and ill will. So in this way, it will be the practice of Satipatthana that can be the means for developing the jhanas, or the means for developing, for going directly into into the development of insight. And so we have these two different interpretations right now, even amongst the followers of Theravada Buddhism. One is the predominant interpretation, but the other has become very influential through the teachings of a certain, the recorded teachings, and maybe YouTube videos of a certain well-known, well-known Buddhist monk, not myself. I don't mention names. Okay, so that's one kind of disagreement. Then another kind of disagreement, actually, agreement about the phrasing, but about the meaning. Actually, this is a very important difference that one finds in understanding the way one practices the 37. All of the 37 aids to enlightenment themselves. This is a difference. There's a general agreement, I would say, within the Theravada school about how to practice. But I've seen an explanation of how to practice the 37, maybe in some commentaries coming from, I've seen it coming from within, amongst Tibetan Buddhists, but I think they're basing themselves maybe on the way is expressed in one of the other early Indian schools of Buddhism. Okay, within the Theravada school, it's understood that the seven groups more or less are laying out pretty much the same groups of factors. Maybe certain factors are more emphasized in some of the groups than in others. And so, for example, when one is taking up the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, one also takes up the practice of the four right efforts. Then as one is practicing the four kinds of mindfulness and the four right efforts, one is also developing simultaneously some of the five faculties, some of the factors of enlightenment, some of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So if one is practicing, say, the four foundations of mindfulness and the four right efforts, one is also practicing simultaneously some of the four bases of spiritual power, some of the four faculties, some of the four powers, some of the seven enlightenment factors, some of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. But another interpretation that I've seen, perhaps coming from another early Indian Buddhist school, perhaps it was the Sarvastivadins, I'm not sure, but they say that first one practices the four foundations of mindfulness, then when one gets them sort of well developed, then one moves on to the four right efforts, then when one gain some degree of mastery over the four right efforts, then one goes on to the four spiritual faculties. When one gets the four spiritual faculties well developed, then one goes on to the four powers. Then when one gets the four powers well developed, then one goes on to the seven factors of enlightenment. Then when one masters the seven factors of enlightenment, then one goes on to the Noble Eightfold Path. But that seems to me, my own personal perspective, there's an agreement here as to the wording, to the phrasing, bhyanjana, there's agreement. But the interpretation differs. One school, the Theravada school, says that one can be developing these seven groups, at least certain factors amongst them, simultaneously. Whereas the other school says that one has to develop the different groups in sequence. And now it seems to me that the view that one has to develop them in sequence, I have to say very frankly, it seems to me to be wrong. Because if one looks at the seven groups, what is the basis for that particular pattern or structure? Moving from the four foundations of mindfulness to the Noble Eightfold Path. What is it that sort of governs this particular sequence? What would you say, Asma?
Mindfulness.
Maybe I'm not getting the answer, the question posed precisely enough. Why are they arranged in this particular sequence? I think that's
from outside.
No. The seven groups, why are they arranged? Right, okay, very good. It's simply arranged according to a numerical sequence. So first we have the fours. Yeah, three groups of fours. Then we have two sets of fives. Then we have a seven. Then we have an eight. And then if you look in the suttas, how is the path factor, the Noble Eightfold Path factor of right mindfulness explained? Let's say the path factor of right effort, it's explained simply as the four right efforts, then how is the factor of right mindfulness explained? Simply by the formula for the four foundations of mindfulness. And so the way that it's explained in the suttas, it seems that the seven groups are not laid out by way of a temporal progression from the four foundations of mindfulness to the Noble Eightfold Path, but rather simply by way of number. And maybe on some occasions the Buddha will teach the four foundations of mindfulness, other occasions he'll teach the five faculties, other occasions the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's just maybe the Buddha teaches in different ways because different people respond to different ways of it, of the presenting the teaching. Okay, now we come to the third type of disagreement. Okay, here we have the case, and this is a very interesting one, where the monks disagree about, the monks agree about the meaning, but they differ about the phrasing. Okay, then in this case, the Buddha says, whichever monk you think is the more reasonable should be approached and addressed thus. The Venerable Ones agree about the meaning but differ about the phrasing. The Venerable Ones should know that it is for this reason, that reason, that there is agreement about the meaning but difference about the phrasing. But the phrasing is a mere trifle. Let the Venerable Ones not fall into a dispute over a mere trifle. So you see, the Buddha isn't so concerned about precision, exactitude in the phrasing, but it's the meaning or substance that's important. And to take a case where there was a difference about the phrasing, but agreement about the meaning, it's the way the second group came to be expressed in different Buddha schools. Now, within the Theravada school, which is based on using the language that we now call Pali, the second group is called the four Sammapadanas. Okay, so it's from this, the use of the word padana by the Buddha, you could see that the Buddha uses it to mean striving, effort, application of energy. But it seems over several generations that the word padana changed its meaning so that it came to mean the sense of primary or substance. And so maybe the later generations of Buddhists, especially when Sanskrit came to be the dominant language amongst the Buddhist community, might have been puzzling over the four pradhanas, which would have meant to them the four substances or the four primaries. And so they were wondering, how could this be the four primaries? And so what happened in the Sanskrit tradition is that the word pradhana got replaced by the word pahana, or in Sanskrit, prahana, which means abandoning. Because one of the four pradhanas is about abandoning unwholesome states. So for that school, or the schools that use Sanskrit, the word pradhana was given up, but the word pahana, and it was replaced with the word pahana. And so they called it the four pahanas, which means the four abandonings. So I think when you have it in Chinese, what do you call that in Chinese? The four... Dwan, yeah. Four jung dwan. The word dwan means abandoning. And I think in the translation into Tibetan also they use the Tibetan word for abandoning. But as far as the definition goes, they were in agreement. So here, if there's a dispute between the followers of the Pali school saying it should be the four pahanas, others say the four pradhanas, the followers of the Sanskrit school say the four pahanas, but they shouldn't fight over this because they're in agreement with the definition, and it's the definition which is the meaning or the substance that's important. Okay, so that is the third case. The fourth case is where there is agreement about the meaning and the phrasing. I don't know why this case should actually be brought up, since if there's agreement about the meaning and the phrasing, I don't see any ground for a dispute at all. So I don't even see why there's a necessity to speak to monks on either sides and to caution them about falling into a dispute. Anybody have any idea how there could be a dispute if there's agreement about the meaning and the phrasing? Maybe a dispute about some other matter that has no relation to the interpretation of the Dhamma. Okay, let's move on to the next section. And this next section has maybe an application beyond the particular, you know, Buddhist community. And it's quite useful advice for settling, for dealing with misbehavior in any kind of community of people. Okay, so here we have the case where the monks are training in concord with mutual appreciation without disputing, and then some monk might commit an offense or a transgression. That is, some transgression of the rules of discipline, and so the need arises to speak to him. And so before the monk speaks to him in order to reproach him, then one has to consider the person in this way. So this is the way one reflects before rebuking the misbehaving person. Okay, one thinks, I shall not be troubled. There are actually four considerations here. First consideration, I shall not be troubled. So one has to take one's own situation into account. And the other person will not be hurt, for the other person is not given to anger and resentment. Okay, the other person, okay, that's the second one. The second consideration, that the other person won't be hurt. The third consideration is that the other person is not firmly attached to his own view, and he relinquishes easily. So if you reproach the other person won't be hurt. And he's the type of person who could easily relinquish his view and change his behavior. And then the fourth consideration is that I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. Okay, if we can bring together all of these four factors, these four considerations, then you should speak to that person. So this is the ideal situation. No trouble for myself, no trouble for the other person relinquishes his view easily, and I can transform that person's behavior. Okay, now we come to the second situation. Okay, in this case, I won't be troubled, but the other person will be hurt. The other person is somewhat sensitive, and he's given to anger and resentment. But, though he, a person who gets angry maybe quickly, provoked a little bit easily, but he's the kind of person who can reflect if you present him good reasons for changing his behavior. So he's not attached to his view, and he'll give up his view easily. So he won't try to defend, though he gets angry, but he won't try to defend himself and to argue and to, you know, promote his own cause. And so in this way, one could make that person give up the unwholesome and adopt the wholesome. So in this case, Buddha says, it's a mere trifle that the other person will be hurt, even though one doesn't like to hurt the other person. But it's a much more important thing that one can convince that person to change his behavior, to give up the unwholesome, and to establish himself in the wholesome. So in this case, it's also the right thing is to speak to that person. Actually, if the other person is hurt, normally one would be somewhat troubled oneself, you know, because one has to face the anger of the other person. But suppose that I have enough control, mastery of my own mind, enough, you know, strong compassion for the other person and well-developed equanimity. Maybe then if the other person gets angry and sort of snaps at me, I can take it and just reason with that person and convince him to give up his misbehavior. Okay, the third case. Okay, I will be troubled because I have to give up my peace and quiet in order to speak to that person. Okay, the other person won't be hurt, for he's not given to anger and resentment. But the third factor is that he's firmly attached to his view, and he relinquishes with difficulty. Okay, maybe this is the kind of person who doesn't get angry, but still he's the kind of person who calmly argues back and tries to defend himself and to, you know, to justify his misbehavior. Okay, but we have now the fourth consideration here is that I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish himself in the wholesome. So again, the Buddha says, it's a mere trifle in this case that I shall be troubled. But it's a much more important thing that I can make this person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. So taking all of these four factors into account, then I should speak to that person. Okay, now we come to the third situation. Okay, when I'm contemplating speaking to the person, I reflect that I shall be troubled. Maybe I get upset easily and I have to give up my peace and quiet to reproach the other person. The other person will be hurt and he might get angry and snap back at me. And he's firmly attached to his view and he'll argue and try to defend himself and convince me that he's doing what is right. So we have three counts against it, three reasons for just keeping quiet. But I realize that I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish himself in the wholesome. So even though there are three counts against it, but if I really persist, I can make that person change his way and adopt the wholesome. So in this case, again, the Buddha says, it's a mere trifle that I shall be troubled and the other person will be hurt and get angry. But it's a much greater thing that I can make that person change from the unwholesome to the wholesome. And so in this case too, even with so much in favor of just keeping silent, but the fact that ultimately I can prevail and transform the other person if I only speak to him and persist. So with that, taking account of that, then I should speak to that person. But then we have the fourth situation. Okay, here the Buddha says, okay, when one reflects on the situation, one realizes, I shall be troubled and the other person will be hurt and get angry. So we have two counts against speaking. Then the other person is firmly attached to his view and gives it up with difficulty. So a third consideration against it. And I cannot make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. So now we have four counts against it. And so to speak to him, to reproach him, is just going to create trouble for myself, trouble for the other. And I'm pretty sure that, well, maybe absolutely sure, maybe I and others have tried speaking to that person, and he just won't change his way. And so in this case, the Buddha says, it's kind of understatement, or maybe it's a very soft and subtle way, he says, one should not underrate equanimity towards such a person. Which means that one should just develop equanimity towards that person. But actually in other suttas, the Buddha says that if there's a person like this who really keeps on persisting in what's wrong, keeps on making trouble and difficulty for everybody else and insists that he's right, what the Buddha says is that you should impose capital punishment on that person. And what is meant by capital punishment in the Buddha's teaching? What is capital punishment? You send them to the gas chambers. What is it? You remember Mahaparinibbana Sutta? Ananda asked the Buddha, what should we do with such and such a monk?
Ostracize ourselves.
in a way that sort of gets the point, but there's an exact expression that the Buddha uses.
Just silently and leave him alone?
Yeah, yeah. The Buddha says that you maintain silence to that person. It means that you don't give him any instruction, don't give him any guidance, and just let him, you know, carry on. And then eventually, the sort of hope is that when he sees that all of the other monks are just treating him, giving him the silent treatment, which doesn't mean that you don't speak any words at all to him. Like if he asks, like, where are we supposed to go for our meal today, you could answer, give him an answer to that question, you know, on little practical matters. But when it comes to matters of giving any kind of Dhamma explanation, you just treat him with complete silence. Even the Buddha used that method sometimes with some disciples. And sometimes there's still another method that one has to use with a monk who creates a lot of trouble in the monastery. And what is that method? This is when all of the monks get together. Very close. You don't, unless he actually breaks one of the fundamental rules, you don't kick out of the Sangha, but you kick out of the monastery. You say, go find another place to live. Then if he really mends his ways, then you could let him stay, but if he just keeps on arguing, then you have to insist to go. Okay, so this is a ways of settling, well, this is a way of dealing with a recalcitrant, troublemaking monk in the monastery. Okay, so first issue in the sutta are disputes within the Sangha, either about the meaning or about the phrasing. The second big issue is about dealing with a monk who is persistently committing transgressions. Now third comes about how to deal with what's called verbal friction that might arise. Okay, so the Buddha says, when you are training in concord with mutual appreciation without disputes, there might arise between you verbal friction, insolence in views, that is maybe obstinacy in maintaining views, then annoyance, bitterness, and dejection. How does one deal with this kind of problem? This would be kinds of disputes that arise not based about the Dhamma, but maybe about personal issues. Maybe one monk has a habit of behaving in a certain way, and so then he has his group of friends who like his way of behaving, other group doesn't like the way he's behaving. And so over some trifling matters of conflict and dispute and even verbal friction arises. So how does one settle this? So the Buddha says, whichever monk you think is the most reasonable on one side, you go to him and say, well, we are training and concord like this, this kind of conflict and quarrel and disputes have arisen. Then one raises the question, if the recluse, here the word used is samana, probably it's obvious from the context it's referring to the Buddha. It seems strange that they're using the recluse. Why don't they use the word bhagava? That would make more sense to me, the Blessed One, or Tathagata. If the Blessed One knew, would he censor that? And so answering this rightly, the monk on the other side would say, certainly if the Blessed One knew about this, he would censor it. The Buddha would criticize them for disputing about such a trifling matter. Okay, then they go to the other side, and they speak to the monk on the other side who's most reasonable, and they say that if the recluse or the Bhagava, if he knew about this, would he criticize us for fighting over this trifling matter? Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped the second question. So then they ask the monk on the first side, without abandoning that thing, can one realize Nibbana? In other words, while all of the monks are fighting and disputing, can they achieve the ultimate goal? Now, because all of them will have bitterness in the mind over this trifling conflict. And so unless they become reconciled with one another and become harmonious and are able to return to the state of training in harmony together, then that bitterness in the mind will always be an obstacle, and so they won't be able to practice successfully. And so answering rightly, the monk on the first side will say, without abandoning that thing, you know, that resentment and bitterness over their disagreement, then we cannot realize Nibbana. Okay, and then they go to the most reasonable monk on the other side, and they ask the same questions, and he'll answer in the same way. And then presumably, once they convince the leading monk on each of the two sides that the Buddha would have reproached them for arguing, and that without getting over this conflict, they won't be able to progress on the way to Nibbana, then the two sides will become reconciled. Okay, now comes the last part of the sutta, and that is how the monk who's serving as the, they call this the arbiter, the one who brings conflicting sides together, how he should respond if questioned about his role. So if others come to him and say, was it you who made those monks emerge from the unwholesome and establish them in the wholesome? Okay, answering rightly, should he say that, yes, I was the one who did that. You should all be grateful to me for playing such an important role in the Sangha, and you should make me the chief monk in the Sangha. Is that the way he should respond? Or should he say it was due to my wisdom, my skill in negotiations that brought the two sides together? No. But the way he should answer should be, here I went to the Blessed One, and the Blessed One taught me the Dhamma. The commentary says that the Buddha taught me the Dhamma, that is, the Buddha explained how to settle disputes or how to speak to a monk who has been misbehaving and to correct his ways so that he'll behave in the right way. So the Buddha taught me the Dhamma. Then when I learned this principle, then I spoke to the monks. And when the monks heard what I taught them based on the Buddha's teaching, then they emerged from the unwholesome and were established in the wholesome. Time. Who's doing that? Okay, I think they're finished now. Okay, so then the Buddha concludes and says, answering thus, this monk neither exalts himself. He doesn't exalt himself by saying, I was the one who did that. I'm so wonderful, I'm so wise, I'm so clever. And he doesn't disparage others. So he doesn't say, oh, those monks were so making so much trouble. Oh, they were so difficult to deal with. Oh, they were just so obstinate. But I brought them together anyway. And in this way, he answers in accordance with the Dhamma in such a way that nothing that he said provides a ground for criticizing him. Okay, so that is the end of the sutta. And I didn't really leave time for questions. But if there's a few questions, we could field them now and then leave the other questions for after lunch. Any questions? Okay, Barbara,
yeah. I feel like I have a big question.
A big question.
In the first section, I don't quite see how having it pointed out that there's something has not been grasped correctly changes.
That something has not been
grasped.
Grasped, yeah.
Yeah, it hasn't been grasped.
Yeah.
How does that change the mind of the person who hasn't grasped it correctly?
Yeah, that's why I raised the question too. I didn't quite get that.
Because most people, I think, would respond, no, my understanding is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe expound the Dhamma first and then you would say.
Yeah, I think that question will be settled in the next sutta that we're going to take in 2 weeks. I remember that was dealt with in the Vinaya, dealing with disputes like that. Basically, what one has to do is choose a very learned monk, or it could be even like a committee of very learned monks, who everyone regards as being sort of trustworthy and reliable in their grasp, both of the wording of the text and their interpretation of the meaning. And one goes to either that one or that group to settle the dispute. Okay, Richard, take the microphone.
What strikes me is that there is no moment in these instructions where the person who is settling the dispute asks himself whether he might be wrong. It does not occur. That is, there's no possibility envisioned that one of the disputants talking to the arbitrator, right, might convince the arbitrator, because the assumption is that all of the issues, right, are ones with which the Buddha has dealt adequately, and that the arbitrator is the perfect student of the perfect master. And so there is no possibility that someone might come up with something that should convince the arbitrator, that the arbitrator should actually change his mind about anything. Hmm. So this can't be done, say, with an arbitrator who doesn't know the entire teaching perfectly, and who isn't able or doesn't feel secure or doesn't act secure in his ability to make all correct practical implications. Mm. If the Buddha is doing this in order to set up a regime which will work after his death, then, you know, the line that seems to resolve things here in paragraph 17, well, you know, I went to the Blessed One fought me, right? It becomes relevant or irrelevant by a lifetime after the Buddha's death, right? That becomes impossible for people to say that.
Yeah.
And so has he really solved the problems that are going to arise?
Yeah, well, I first, you know, because the sutta has to be compact, so I think it can't take all the contingencies into account. But in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha says that, you know, after I've passed away, it's the Dhamma and Vinaya, the Dhamma taught by me and the Vinaya laid down or proclaimed by me that should be your teacher after I'm passing away. But the plain simple fact is that, you know, even setting up the Dhamma and the Vinaya as the guide didn't settle all the different possibilities, or didn't settle, remove all the possibilities for different ways of preserving the text and the letter, and also for different interpretations. So probably that is why, especially as the Sangha spread to different geographical regions, then the monks in different communities were faced with interpreting maybe the same body of text, but different interpretations arose. And once they came together again, then they found that they were that their interpretations were so different that they actually formed different schools.
Yeah,
yeah, so that happened.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll take one more, then we'll have to stop. From
Michael. I thought Richard's question was particularly relevant to the sense that this sutra appears to me to be about have two major elements. One is the content that's being discussed, but even more important perhaps, and this is the way I felt it, the structure within which the content is discussed or dealt with or resolved. So
explain what you mean by the structure within which...
Well, the structure of how we, of being attached to things and our willingness to detach ourselves, seems to be more relevant. The idea of having a view which may be right or may be wrong, but our ability to detach ourselves from holding on to the view, I'm referring to the structure as that, as being more important than what the view might be.
I think that's also, I mean, that's very important, but the Buddha does emphasize that it's important to be right as far as the atta, as far as the meaning goes. Though the byanjana, the phrasing, the wording differences, he says, are a mere trifling. Okay, we'll have to stop now, and then we could come back for more discussion, say 10 after 12. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing the merits. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shirang rakantu sasana. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shirang rakantu desana. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Okay, next one, the short way. Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva numodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe bhuta numodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe sadhanu modantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avichetato etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamochantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, next week we won't have the class on Saturday because there is a weekend meditation retreat here, the Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing retreat. I think if you want to take that retreat, you can still register for it. So we'll have the next class will be 2 weeks, April 17th. Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. Time goes very quick. August 17th. And we take sutta number 104. You can read the whole sutta. If some of the middle portions seem a bit technical and detailed, don't worry about them. But it's mainly the beginning parts and the parts at the end that are most important. But that deals with the Buddha explaining to the Sangha again how to preserve the teaching, to maintain, to avoid disputes and maintain harmony within the Sangha. Okay, so we end with the three vows.
Out of bounds.